So you understood what I was talking about this morning? I mean, it's pretty difficult to understand. It's a completely new perspective. I mean, our society is based on using. We are using others and others are using us. That's a common principle. That's it. That is how community works. I mean, there's nothing, you know, to feel guilty about. I mean, that is just the way it is. I mean, even if you do not use people, but, you know, there are only a few people in this whole world who don't use other people. And they have to live like hermits. But they still use the plants. They need some food, some shelter, some clothing to protect them. So they have to use the animals, and the animals are also beings. If they eat them, if they eat honey, you know, they have to use the food of the bees, or otherwise, you know. Using and to be used, you know, that is a common principle of our community as beings. I just wanted to make it clear, you know, for us, you know, to see. And for us in the world, you know, some people, you know, we allow to use us, and other people we don't. And that's why we get into trouble. Why is this person using me? We are constantly using other people. The first time it was getting really clear to me was when I was living for the fourth year in the monastery. I saw this monk was using me for his benefits, and that monk was using me for that benefit, and I saw myself using this monk for my benefit, and using that monk for my benefit, for that kind of benefit, because I want this, you know, so I used him. And he wanted that, you know, and he used me. But that is pretty common, you know, in a community. We are as monks, you know, and the Lord Buddha was very wise to do it. We as monks are dependent of the lay people. I mean, whatever we have, we get from the lay people. We get our food from the lay people. That means four requisites. We get all the four requisites. The four requisites is the food. We get the food from the lay people. We get the shelter from the lay people. We get the clothing from the lay people. And we get medicine from the lay people. Everything, you know, that we have or that we own as a community or own as a person monk, comes from lay people. And we are the field of merit for these lay people. That is, in Western sense, it's of course an unknown or more or less unknown thing, you know, being the field of merit for lay people. I mean, they can do, you know, in giving to us, you know, they do merit. They make good karma. So the Lord Buddha, wise as he was, he didn't allow us to allow the monks to become independent. Because he wanted this dependency of the lay people and them. So that the monks, if they are finished with their training, they can teach the lay people to become better people, to follow the rules. The Lord Buddha himself was teaching the lay people. He was teaching them the five precepts, mostly of all, you know. He was teaching them the five precepts. He was teaching them respect and generosity and gratitude. I mean, that is the most common teaching, you know, for the lay people. Whoever wants to go and go along the path of practice to the end of dukkha, he has to go to undergo some further training. So that is the thing that the monks give back, but it's not in any sort of material form. It's all immaterial. But when one looks, you know, in Thailand, mostly the monks are used as a field of merit. Only renowned Achans are used as a field of source of Dhamma. Dhamma, you can see as the water, you know, that extinguishes the fire of lust or greed in their hearts, or reduces the water of Dhamma. But when we look now and see Tanatha Mahaboha, he is mostly used as a field of merit. People want to give. He doesn't need these things. We have our four requisites, and our four requisites are minimum, what we need. Yeah? A bowl of rice every day, you know, it's satisfactory for us. Once in a while, a bit of medicine, and once in a while, you know, a new piece of cloth. And, some sort of shelter. When we don't find a cave, or on the hanging cliff. So the dependency is there always in this world. As long as we are born, and just think about the dependency of a child. You know, we are dependent on our parents for at least 15 to 16 years. Before we can stand on our own feet. And then, of course, we try to pay it back if we can. You know, we give other people, other beings, the chance, you know, to be raised by us, to be fed by us, to be cared for by us. If we're not, then we can go out in other fields. So using and being used, that is the most common thing in this world. Not only in this world, you know. In this world of the humans, it's also in the world of the animals, or in other realms of being. But the situation of a lay practitioner practicing in a monastery is a bit different. He is neither a monk nor is he a layperson. He is called a monk, but not in the, you know, when you look at the true word for monk, it's an ordained monk. Monk in the sense of a practitioner. He is a practitioner. So he comes into the monastery. He's invited by the monks to come in a monastery, like you invite your friend to come into your house, and your parents automatically will care for him, give him shelter or give him food. So the lay people, and it doesn't matter if they are Thai lay people or Western lay people, they are cared for. They are invited to come to this monastery. They are invited to take care, to participate in the practice of this monastery, and they are not required to give anything. They just take share. They just take share in the life. If you want to consider it, you know, the best example to consider it, they're just like children of the monks. The monks take care of them, they feed them and they give them shelter, and they also teach them. So they're actually, you know, more in the role of the parents. And it is different. And we certainly do have to have a certain amount of respect and a certain amount of gratitude to be able, and especially as Western, to be able to take that what is given to us. A child, you know, doesn't think about it, but we are adults. But we live like a child in this monastery. And we actually cannot pay back. There's no way, you know, to pay back the generosity that comes from the monks or from the monastery. Even, you know, we we can give a little, you know, that is fine, or we can give much, that is also fine. But it is like the Lord Buddha said, you can't pay back even if you work your whole life very hard. You can't pay back the merit that your parents did unto you. It's impossible. It's so much merit that they did for you in these 15 or 16 years that they raised you. It's impossible to pay back to your parents. I mean, you can be a good parent, you know, and give it forth to your children. And then they give it forth to their children, and so on and so on. So it's a different kind of role, yeah? When people come as lay people, and I'm not talking only about Westerners who come to a Thai monastery. I'm talking about also Thai lay people. They're in a special situation. They receive the food, they receive shelter, and they receive all the things that they need. And including that, they will receive Dhamma instructions. Not like you go to a meditation center, you pay your amount, no matter if it is asked for, if it is hidden behind dana, you know, give dana as much as you want. That also you feel you paid for something and you get something. But in a monastery, we are on the receiving end. Well, it's not very different from a monk, you know. A monk is always on the receiving end. A monk gets everything what he needs for his life from the lay people. So a practitioner who's lives in the monastery like a monk, you know, gets everything also from the lay people, or in this case from the monks. So give your heart a little twist. Try to understand it. There's nothing wrong, and you don't even have to feel guilty about it. See it as your good fortune. See it as your good fortune. You have to be able to stay in a place like that, where you're not required, you know, to do hard work, you know, to work for your living. And then take the opportunity, because it is rare. Take the opportunity to make the utmost of your practice. I mean, if you feel guilty, then practice harder. Yeah. That is what is required, yeah? So if it, you know, you stay here to be able to practice, the more you practice, the more actually you can work off your guilt, if you have one. You don't feel to be guilty. I hope, you know, I explained it, I explained the situation thoroughly enough for you to understand. But we just do not sell Dhamma. Yeah? Maybe there are monasteries, you know, who ask you for money or ask you for your support. You know, it's their problem. But it's not within the forest tradition. I mean, we receive as monks, we receive everything for our livelihood. And when we are then in the position, you know, to give, then we give everything that we have. And you don't have to feel guilty, you know, that something is given to you. I know it is, especially in the Western culture, it is deep within us. You know, we feel guilty and we try to do something, you know. Just try to practice a bit more. And then, you know, then share the merit of your practice with the people who are around you. With your co-practitioners, with the monks, or with the lay people who support you. Okay, that's fine. That's all what you can do. And actually this kind of merit is not less, you know, than any other thing. I do sometimes say this, you know, that you're using me, or this morning I was saying it pretty strongly, that you're using me and don't give me anything back. But, you know, the joy of parents is, you know, the happiness of the child. And that's the joy of the parents, you know. They have to suffer a lot, you know, because of that child, because they constantly have to look after it, yeah? Teach it, yeah? Make it a good person. So does the monk have to look after the lay people who come here to practice to make it a good person, to feed it, to look after its needs? But the joy of a monk is if that person, you know, develops in his practice. I mean, you know, get independent as soon as possible, you know. That is the biggest joy you can get, huh? And then go out and whatever you want to do, you know. Then you can go in the field of a lay person, or you can really ordain as a monk, huh? Whatever is your choice. And when you become a lay person, then you can support the monastery, huh? I mean, the monasteries, you know, that support, you know, support the lay people, or the monasteries that just, you know, support the monks practicing in different ways. But for now, you know, just feel the honor to be invited at your friend's place. And friend is not a bad word, yeah? The Lord Buddha said, you know, akalayana mitta, and that is a spiritual friend. So he invites you, you know, to come. Eh? And akalayana mitta is as was pointed out by the Lord Buddha, is full of the spiritual life. It's 100% the spiritual life. It's not only like the Venerable Ananda suggested, Lord Buddha, you know, having a kalayana mitta is half of the spiritual life, isn't it? No, don't say so, my Venerable. Having a kalayana mitta, I mean a spiritual friend, is 100% of the spiritual life. He can give you, he can guide you, just like a friend can give you and guide you and help you and support you. A good friend is there, you know. I don't know, not in many countries it's any more known, you know, but a good friend is there. A good friend is just like your father and mother, you know, who completely support you. Whenever you're in trouble, you know, they help you out. Whenever you do something wrong, they scold you. And say, that's not the right way, my dear friend, you know. That's a way, you know, that goes to destruction. And so is it with a monk or with a teacher, you know, who tells you, you know, this path, my dear friend, you know, that goes to destruction, or this path leads to hell, or this path leads to the animal realm, or this path leads to the ghost realm. I would advise you not to walk any further on it, and redeem your action and cleanse your heart, and that is what you come here for, you know, to cleanse the heart. And cleansing the heart, it starts with sati, and it ends with sati. Sati, mindfulness, is the most important thing in our practice. It's just so utterly important. So important that the Lord Buddha said, somebody who has mindfulness for 7 days and 7 nights can find enlightenment after these 7 days or 7 nights. I mean, he never loses his mindfulness in these 7 days and 7 nights. So he can find enlightenment. That is the importance of sati. That's the importance of mindfulness or awareness. And then he goes on, you know, if your mindfulness is not that firm, you know, it might take you seven weeks, 7 months, or seven years, or 7 lifetimes. It depends on the strength of sati. So that is what we are going to develop. In the beginning, we have to develop sati, 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 sati. And without sati, we don't get any step further, we always get a step back. That means, you know, if we prepare ourselves our coffee, our mindfulness is with preparing a cup of coffee. And our mind is not going, what am I going to do after drinking the coffee, or what did I do before drinking the coffee. It is only obsessed, or it is only observing the making the drink and the drinking the drink. And then it's the same thing, you know, with going to the toilet and shit. I mean, we are only observant of the the action of relieving us from the shit that is in our intestines. We are not concerned what we are going to do next, and we are not concerned what we are doing, what we did before. That is mindfulness. And the same thing with washing our clothes. Yeah, washing our clothes. We are mindful washing the clothes. And mindful washing or doing any kind of action, drinking or, you know, relieving us, or even washing or taking a bath. We can be mindful of the Buddha, or we can be mindful of the Buddha and the movement of the body. And that is especially useful when we wash our clothes. You know, we do a lot of movement. Or when we sweep the path. We do not think what happened before or what we are going to do now and what we are going to do after and what we are going to do after that and after that and after that. Because then we are not mindful. Then we are not aware of what is going on. Then we do not catch these little glimpses that come up during washing. I just don't like it. You know? It's unpleasant. You know, why do I have to do this washing? Or why do I have to do this sweeping? We catch them immediately and, you know, we just broom them out, you know, we just, what's a proper word? I don't know. Quart them out. It's a tiger. We just sweep them out. Okay? If we are not mindful with whatever we are doing right now, even when we change our sitting position, or when we scratch, then we know we are mindful that we are scratching and we are not thinking about something else. We are just mindful of scratching. And then actually we might even be so aware that we know that this scratching actually does increase the pain instead of reducing the pain. We don't notice it, so we scratch and we scratch and we scratch and we think, you know, it is reducing the pain. But actually it is increasing. Because we don't get all these things that happen, you know, in our life, and practice is not only the formal sitting practice and the walking practice. That is what is getting us, you know, wisdom and our samadhi. But the practice is actually the practice of living in a forest. That's why a forest tradition is called also the forest university. The forest teaches us. So we have to be mindful of what is going on. When we walk down the hill, you know, we are mindful. We are mindful of the walking, or we are mindful of the Buddha, or we are mindful of the breath, or we are mindful of the combination. You know? There's a lot of action going on within our body. When we walk down or when we walk up. But we think only, you know, why, you know, now I'm only at half, or now I'm, you know, I still have so much to go, so much to go. That's what we think, huh? That is not mindful. I mean, just taking one step at a time, that is mindful, you know, being aware, you know, of the step and the movement and the muscle, huh? And the muscles, of course, do ache, huh? Because we are not used to it anymore. In 2 weeks' time, you know, nobody will think about it anything anymore. Because we are used to it. Our muscles that have not been used, and I notice it very much, have not been used for 10 months, you know, are showing off. Huh? They're showing a change. Huh? And we call it pain or ache or whatever. But it's just a change. Now they are going to be used, you know, something that is rusty, you know, of course, you know, until it moves smoothly, you know, it takes a little bit of force. So, that's all what is happening within our body. This muscle is moving, that muscle is moving, this kind of flesh or the muscle pad or whatever, you know, is moving as well. And things that have been quiet through our position or through our doings in the past, you know, that have never been moved, you know, are suddenly going to be moved and are giving us some pain. But actually what is happening is some changes are taking place. And changes are constantly taking place in our body. So I just want you to be aware. I just want to be much more, having much more subtlety, much more mindfulness on what you are doing. In every kind Even if you get up then, you know, when the talk is finished, when you get up, you know, be mindful of getting up. Be mindful of walking down the stairs. Be mindful of brushing your tooth. And don't think ahead, huh? Oh, I want to do this, I want to do that, you know, why I'm not finished, huh? That is, you know, that is living a life of mindfulness. Like the Lord Buddha said, you know, or advised his bhikkhus, the moment you open your eyes, you are mindful, or you are aware that you open your eyes. The moment you get up, you are aware that you get up. The moment you put on your robe, you are aware that you are putting on your robe. I mean, these things are so accustomed to us that we never pay attention to them anymore. I mean, just putting on the robe, you know, do you ever pay attention to that? Putting on your shirt or your trousers, do you put attention to it? Or washing or soaping up your body, do you put attention to it? No, you think about this or think about that. It's so common, it's such a common task. Even eating, you know, you're not even aware, you know, of chewing. You're just aware of what you eat, what you want to taste next. Chewing and gulping it down, you know. Putting it down the throat, you know, how it goes down the throat, the food, huh? Are you aware of that? Yeah, how it goes down the throat, you know, when does the food loses the sense of taste? I mean, that are all areas of investigation. We do still have to live, you know, and when we do still have to live, we have to eat and we have to drink and we have to we have to shit and we have to wash our body and we have to wash the utensils that we are using. Clean. Isn't it? But, you know, we are used now for 30 or 50 years, you know, to these common tasks that we never pay any attention to them. And that's where our mindfulness is lacking. And that's why our practice is not progressing so. Because we lose a lot of our attention, we lose a lot of our focus in these simple tasks that we think, you know, that are necessary for all life, you know, to live on, that we think are waste. No, use them. Use them for your wisdom. Use them for investigation. And you will see, you know, washing clothes is not as bad as we always think it is. Doing this or washing dishes is not as bad, you know, it's just an action, it's just a movement of this muscle and that muscle. When we walk up, it's a movement of that muscle and this muscle. I mean, you know, we have placed symbols on it. We have placed symbols on work and we have placed symbols on pleasure. I mean, one man's pleasure is the other man's pain. Like one man's poison is the other man's medicine. I mean, it's just a definition. And that is, you know, all our life is defined. It's defined by our own definition. And we constantly struggle again, you know, to get this definition, you know, that the other person also believes our definition. Because if the other person believes our definition, then we feel secure. That's why we want, you know, that's mostly the reason, you will see it. It's mostly the reason, it's the real intention behind you want to communicate with somebody. You want to make somebody sure, you know, or, you know, if you can't convince him, you know, at least get convinced by him, then at least you have two people believing, you know, the same crap. And if a lot of people, you know, believe the same crap, you know, then we believe it's the truth. So 50 years ago, the Germans all believed, you know, that all the fault, you know, with Germany was the Jews. You know, millions of people believed it. You know, but it was crap. Well, this is using these people as a scapegoat for their own faults, for their own mistakes. I mean, convincing, you know, and that is mostly, you know, just look at your talk. Just look before you open your mouth, what you want to communicate. Even if you talk about Dhamma or practice, You want to either you want to show off, you know, see, you know how good I am, or you want to show off in a negative sense, see how bad I am. I mean, that is just the same reason. Or you want to convince somebody, you know, this practice, you know, that I was doing is really bringing good food. You know, you should try it. I mean, what other intentions are there? Oh, you know, most of the people, when we look back when we were lay people, mostly we try to convince other people that we are good. Isn't it? I mean, that is the most purpose of our, you know, we show off our good sides, you know. We even know it from our own sayings, you know, in our language. I mean, the first time we meet the other sex, you know, we show off. Only our good sides, right? And of course, you know, the woman or the other sex does the same thing. And then after a while, you know, we get used to each other and then we see all the shit. And then we get disgusted, you know, and get our divorce. Or separate, huh? One way or the other. I mean, yeah. Just like it said, you know, life is just showing off, huh? Or convince other people. I mean, if my purpose of teaching is to convince you that my practice is good, you know, my practice is useless, no? Really. I don't have to convince anybody. If I can't convince myself that my practice is good, you know, then there's no use, huh, to convince a thousand of people. And that is most, you know, that is mostly behind these huge gatherings. Huh? I mean, that doesn't mean that the practice is completely useless. Huh? But it means you will lack confidence. And where is the confidence? Where can we find our confidence? Well, you can find it in our heart. That's where it is. If we know something is good, we know it in our hearts that something is good. Even if the other person tells us this is shit, we still know it's good. Because we have a good feeling. I mean, a good feeling is an indication that something, you know, is good and not bad. A bad feeling is always an indication that something is, you know, not right. I mean, the moment our heart gets excited, you know, we know there's something not right, you know, we don't know yet, wrong. If it's really bad or if it's, you know, if it's not so bad. But there's something is not right. Because we get excited. And excitement can be in a negative sense, you know, however we put our definition on it. Or it can be in a positive sense. Lust is called, you know, and lust we normally consider as a positive thing. It's also exciting. Fear we consider as a negative, in a negative sense. And that is not so exciting. I mean, fear is pretty much, you know, depressing. All the negative things, you know. Just, you know, and all, you know, point back to the root, you know, what is actually going on? Huh? I mean, there's a feeling, okay. The feeling instantly we know if it's good or bad, or if it's neutral. That means if it's pleasant or unpleasant, or it's neutral. We know it. If we don't have to ask, you know, this person, is my feeling good or bad, or is it neutral? We know it. Instantly we know it. We know that there is still, you know, that there is still this body, and with the body comes the six senses. We know that they are still there. So keep everything in the confinement of the five khandhas, of the five groups. You know, and then we don't need these labels, this is good and this is bad, this is lust and this is greed. You know, we just see what is going on. There's a vedana, you know, there's a feeling, you know, that triggers a thought or a memory. Oh, okay, that is a memory. And the moment we say there is a memory, that memory is gone. There might be a new memory. If you can't, you know, if our mindfulness is not so much, you know, then this vedana and memory and thought goes through a few cycles to build up an emotion. And then we have to deal with a much harder stuff. I mean, I'm depressed. I'm not good, you know. That I'm not good doesn't come, you know. I come in, you know, as the first thought. It comes in through an unpleasant feeling and comes through a memory. I had this again, you know. And that is because of that, you know. I feel guilty about this or I feel guilty about that. And then we think I'm not a good person, yeah. And look at all the others, yeah, they're also good, yeah. This is just the way of the kilesas to pull us down. I mean, you know, one way is, you know, to pull us down, to deter us from the practice. Or the one thing is to make us, you know, so overconfident that we think we don't need to practice. Oh, everything is fine already. We're complete. That's two of the modes, you know, the kilesas using to, you know, deter us from the practice. No matter how high we are up, you know, we still can practice. No matter how low we are down, you know, we still can practice. But, you know, just think about it. What is low and what is high? Low? It's not in the, it's not mentioned within the five khandhas, is it? High? Is it mentioned within the five khandhas? No. It's not even mentioned within the six senses. The senses of eye contact, the senses of hearing, ear contact, the senses of taste contact, the senses of smell contact, the senses of touching, or the senses of thinking. I mean, where is the low and where is the high and where is the good and where is the bad? Huh? Think about it clearly, and whenever these things come up, you know, then first put it away from you. Use the principle of anatta, that is not me, that doesn't belong to me, this is not myself, until you can see it in front of you. And once you can see it in front of you, you can analyze it. Oh, that was just a Vedana. Or that was a combination of Vedana and memory. Or if your memory is good, you know, you find it even, oh, it rotated two times. Huh? There was a feeling in the beginning, then there was a memory, then there was thought, you know, that triggered that feeling. Yeah? And that feeling triggered another memory that was very similar to it, you know, that had strong emotions. Huh? And that triggered a thought, and then I caught it. And it's gone. If I don't catch it, you know, it suddenly, you know, it rushes over like, you know, we are bathed in hot water. I mean, just don't let that happen, you know. Just raise your awareness or raise your sati or mindfulness. It's just the same thing, you know, it just means the same thing. Mindfulness, sati, or actually mindfulness, you know, can be mind emptiness. It can be also having the mind full of one. Just one thing. Just a thing that we are just experiencing. Full of one thing. Not of thousand. Mindfulness, sati, or awareness. You know, whatever triggers your the right sense within. Just being aware, and I still feel, you know, from my perspective, from my understanding of awareness, it's much closer, you know. Being aware that there's a feeling coming in, being aware that there's a thought coming in, being aware that a memory pops up, or being aware that there's a touch or one of the sense contact. So we stay at that, yeah. And then we see the next thing, okay. After the eye contact, there comes an ear contact. Or after the ear contact, there comes an eye contact. And, of course, with each contact of the senses, comes a feeling. Comes a Vedana. It might be strong, or it might be weak, or it might be even neutral. It can be of pleasant kind, it can be of unpleasant kind, or it can be of neutral kind. The neutral one we are not experiencing very often. But actually, they are present most of the time. You just don't care about neutral feeling. You just hanker for the good feelings, or if you can't get good feelings or pleasant feelings, you hanker for the unpleasant feelings. Because they are more exciting. Of course, a good feeling is more exciting. An unpleasant feeling is also exciting. The neutral feelings, it's boring. There's no excitement. And what we hanker for in our life is excitement, yeah? I mean, something must happen, you know. Something, at least, you know, even if, when I practice hard, something must happen. And you will see, you know, you have to be patient. There might 7 years, might nothing happen. And not, I mean, not in the sense that you think it has happened. Just, you know, as if you step on the grass, you know. The longer you step on the grass, the flatter it gets, right? But you don't see it because you want to have it bold, you know. But if you walk, you know, for years, you know, there will be no grass more growing anymore. I mean, that is, yeah. So don't expect things, you know, to happen, you know, just do your work. And here, of course, being in the forest, you know, being in that precious environment, and just be sure, you know, and not many that have this chance to be in this kind of environment, to be so close to the forest, not completely in the forest, but so close to the forest, and so close to nature as nearly as possible. So take this opportunity. And of course, what is happening is, when you are so close to the nature, you will have to learn from the nature. But everything that the nature is doing is reflecting your own thoughts. It's reflecting your own memories. It reflects your own state of being. So, here in this kind of environment, where there is nothing externally happening, in the sense that we are used to in bigger monasteries or in monasteries close to the city, because the closest city is actually, you know, it's 70 kilometers away. They're just these villages, you know, some are a little bit bigger than this. 200 houses. And that's what you will find for the next 60 kilometers. Until you go to the provincial city of this province of Loi, or in the other direction, you know, it will be 120 kilometers to Tilodon, or maybe 80 or 90 kilometers to Nong Khai. So, and what lies in it are just small villages where people live actually a very simple life. And we take part in the simple life. There's not much happening. So, and if there's not much happening, all whatever, you know, we experience is happening within our own chitta. And that might not be easy to take. So if you feel that you can't take it, you know, then just move back, you know. If you're in a cave, you know, and you can't take it, you know, then just move back, you know, from the cave for 3 days. Or if you're in a location where strange things are happening and you feel you can't deal with it, then just move back for a while, you know, just for a few days, yeah? Until things clears up, you know, and then go again, you know, and see, you know, what is actually happening. What is getting pulled up? Because if everything is so quiet, we don't have any distractions, and the only thing that is happening is the happenings within our own chitta. And now, in this kind of quiet or remote area, we are able to see. And the problem is, do we really want to see? The first time, of course, not, because it's not pleasant what we see. It's not to our liking what we are going to see. And these things we have to deal with. We have to find a way, we have to find a skillful means, you know, to deal with these things that are happening. So I won't scold, you know, if I see you attracting. Or even if that place becomes too much, then go down to the village monastery. That's fine. I mean, you know, I don't scold you. I know how difficult it is, you know. Some people can take it better, some people cannot take it. And I will, you know, but however, if you think, you know, you want to break instead of make it, then I will give a recommendation, huh, to let go of it. I might see these things a little bit before you. It's not good, you know, to break something. Huh? It's always good, you know, to fight is good. Huh? To fight the things that are within our chitta, you know, that constantly bother us, this is fine. Yeah? But, you know, to break it, you know, to actually break through it. In a sense, you know, that uses a lot of power. That is not helpful, not helpful for our practice. So be skillful. Be skillful in all these things. To see, you know, what is coming out of it. And the more mindfulness you have, you know, the more easy it is to see. It is just like having a bright flashlight, yeah? If you have little mindfulness, your flashlight is very dull. But if you have, you know, if you have 100% mindfulness, you see everything. It's just like you're holding a flashlight and you see every scratch, every move, everything, every piece of dust. So that is the importance of mindfulness. And now coming back to the mindfulness, you know, it's a good way to end this talk.